Okay, good morning, everybody, and welcome to Chatting Between Takes, Conversations with My Father, Episode 3. So for those of you who've been following Chatting Between Takes since my first season, I call it, this is Season 2. This is a special drop, I like to call it, which is Conversations with My Father, Eugene Benson. Dad, how are you doing today?
Not too bad at all.
How's your morning been?
Excellent recovery from Halloween. I had two candies, and so I'm getting back to normal.
So you live in a condominium here in the beaches in Toronto, or the beach, as people call it now. Any trick-or-treaters come through here?
Oh, yeah, lots.
Really?
Oh, yeah, right. All the residents of the condos here, they bring stuff down to the front desk, and then all the kids are invited by, and so dozens of them come by all evening. Oh, yeah.
Did you ever used to dress up in Ireland for Halloween?
And no, never did.
Just not a real thing there?
It wasn't a big thing dressing up, but they did have things like, apples. They would have apples covered with treacle and
that's good.
That kind of thing. And then what we would have would be baking apple pies and that kind of thing. And you would put money inside that. That was very an old traditional idea. Put money inside, sixpence, a penny, etc. And you would know that was coming up, so you wouldn't swallow it. But it wasn't celebrated as it is here.
And then did you get to Canada in the 50s when you went to Saskatchewan, and were people dressing up there?
And no, because where I was living on a farm.
Okay.
There was no town, there was no village even.
Right, so it would have been a really boring night waiting for kids to come by.
I was teaching in a one-room school, all grades to grade 10, except for grade 7. And so the farms were, maybe 2 or 3 miles apart.
Right.
So there really wasn't too much of that.
Right.
Now, there was a big concert, a big school concert held where all the people would come along around Halloween, but not necessarily on that day. So there was a celebration. And remember, these were all people who had just arrived from Europe. When I say just, I meant within the past 25 years.
Right.
Before that, total wilderness, the indigenous people, obviously, living there or passing through, but then with so many Scandinavians, Norwegians, Finnish, Scottish, and that kind of thing, the traditions had not yet been established.
Okay, so when's the first time? I've got two questions about this because I think that's really interesting. When's the first time you clocked, oh wow, everybody's dressing up for Halloween and trick or treating's happening? Like around when did that become a thing?
For me, that became a thing here in Canada in the cities in the late 1950s.
Okay.
Then it was very, very much there. Yeah.
And do you think that had to do with like homogenization, where people were going, we're Canadian now and we're going to kind of do this?
Right. And of course, in a town I was living in, Guelph then, kids could get back and forth from the houses very, very easily.
Right.
So that then, that would be it.
So when you got here, 1954, right?
Right.
What, make this up, but what percentage of people were actually born in Canada that you met versus immigrated?
I would say that 50% of the people when I was living in Guelph were immigrants, 50%.
Right.
When I first went my first year in Saskatchewan, northern Saskatchewan, way north of Prince Albert, I would say that 90% of all the people I met were immigrants.
Wow.
90%.
So what do you 90%. Think when you see all this rhetoric, anti-immigration rhetoric? I mean, who cares if you're from Somalia or from Scandinavia? You're coming to a new country to have a better life. What do you think when you see this and you go, there used to be way more immigration?
Oh,
percentage-wise.
Percentage-wise, absolutely. I mean, Canada has always been characterized by immigration. The First World War, huge numbers arrived, especially the Ukraine. Enormous arrived from the Ukraine. The Germans had there at times too. The Irish, of course, came in the 19th century. After the Great Famine in the 1840s, there were hundreds of thousands of Irish who made their way to Canada because there was nothing in Ireland except death. I mean, over a million people died of hunger. So there were...
What a riveting statement. There was nothing in Ireland except death.
That's
what I mean. What people are fleeing in Syria or wherever today, right?
Exactly. And the other thing we must remember is...
They're fleeing death.
There can be a coincidence here of, goodwill, philanthropy, feeling, generous towards one's fellow mankind. But there's also the economic advantage.
Right.
every 5 years we need more and more and more people. You know, in so many lines, there is work to be offered. Now, you might turn around and say, but unemployment. Unemployment in Canada at the moment is very, very low.
Oh, yeah.
Very low, comparatively speaking. So we need people.
Absolutely.
And so when I look at the hospitals, you know, I saw with Mum's death, most of the young women are the women who are serving and looking after the patients there. They are from, I discover, Tibet, Eritrea. You name these places that you've only known before on a map, and suddenly you see these people looking after the elderly people, the sick people of Canada.
Well, in Mum's case, beautifully.
And beautifully they're doing this.
Yeah.
So we need them. So to turn around and say, these foreigners coming in, taking over here, we need them.
Correct. Now, I know that there's, you know, the idea that you talked about this with Timothy Eaton, you could get a job if you were Irish. But, you know, obviously the Irish dealt with some racism. Italians dealt with some racism when they arrived. But then they become the entrenched. Why do you think people are so vehemently against, let's say, Syrians? Do you think it's racist, or do you think it's just, you know, that would have been the same racism toward an Irishman back in the day, but then you assimilate or become part of the mosaic?
Well, you know, those are questions that, you know, probably a sociologist could better answer.
Right.
But I think what is this, that one of the instincts that we have, instincts like love, hate, jealousy, among them is acquisition. You know, I want something, building a nest, building a home.
Yep.
And once you've got your spot, you know, then that sense of defending your own territory is absolutely elemental. And so there is, I think, in human nature, a natural urge, whether we like it or not, to protect what we have.
Right.
And that extends on a larger scale in a nation to saying, we're here, we're now comfortable,
right,
let's keep those other people out. Now, what happens, of course, is with good education, with in a society like Canada, government, continually making its laws say you can't discriminate, that instinct to reject the foreigner is, how would I say, civilized. And so we do come to a kind of modus vivendi where we recognize, by and large, that we must help our fellow people, and then we accept them. And the curious thing is, once we accept the other, discover...
That's it, right?
The other is ourselves.
Well, that's it. And, you know, there's that great idea that, like, we have more in common with the citizens of the country we're at war with than the leaders of our own country.
Exactly.
Because those leaders are, you know, effectively living in gold palaces, and I'm not against that. Good for them. As we know, we like success. But at the same time... you know, MBS and Trump have more in common with each other, but they'll suggest that the citizens of the country should be against one another in a way that's so absurd.
You're right. There's a wonderful story, true, by the way, not apocryphal, told about the First World War. Christmas came along, and the British, the Tommies, as they called them, could hear the Germans singing, you know, Silent Night, Stille Nacht, and they could hear their Tommy sing the very same song written by an Austrian, if I remember. And the next day, Christmas Day, what happened? The British soldiers and the German soldiers jumped out of their trenches and they played a football game together. Literally, that is a true story.
I think there's a film about that. That just gives me goosebumps right now.
Yeah, I know. They played soccer together. What happened then? The word came down from the top ranks saying, not to be allowed.
Right.
Stop this. This is treason. And here is the human instinct of the soldiers who then went back to killing each other.
But the next day,
their natural instinct was to play together.
Oh, yeah.
And then they're told you've got to kill each other.
Very
odd
thing.
That is patriotism. Wonderful poem called Dulce et Decorum Est, a Latin phrase meaning it is a lovely and sweet thing to die for one's country.
And, I mean, sounds like a version of the kamikazes, too.
Exactly. And that, by the way, when the poet wrote it, I've forgotten whether he was killed in war, but it was totally satiric.
Right.
It's not, you know, it was terrible. And anyway, we won't go into that First World War story.
Well, okay, so on that note, we have a question from Terry Malloy, one of my Instagram followers and possibly a fan. Hey, Terry, how you doing? Thanks for the question. Dad, have you ever been in a fight?
Ever been in a fight? Yes.
Okay, let's get into this because, by the way, very quickly, my karate teacher, Sensei Legacy, who I've been training with for 26 years, this weekend is being inducted into the Black Belt Hall of Fame. And after my dad and I record this podcast, I'm going to drive down to Gatineau for the ceremony for that. So, you know, I engaged in the fighting arts around age 18. But tell me about your fights, Dad.
Well, you took karate and then you're now taking jiu-jitsu.
And still the karate,
when,
of course.
When I was about 10, I discovered in my house, in Ireland, a book on jiu-jitsu.
God, I wish you had that book.
And I began teaching myself jiu-jitsu, which meant, in my case, it was really a form of wrestling.
Right.
So as soon as I would fight, I would get in close, and then I would use head grips, neck grips, that
right.
kind of thing. And that always meant that in fights, I would come out not necessarily superior, but by holding the other person, that native has got bloodied or
well,
that kind of thing.
That's actually the idea about a lot of these jiu-jitsu things is to neutralize.
But the first time when I was in college, that wasn't the kind of thing. The boys would say, a fight, and you'd go to a special spot that was reserved,
yep.
and you would square off with your fists.
Right.
And it ended up that I've had some, I don't know what was the cause of it, with a guy whose name I still remember, Jerry Meehan, and we squared off with our fists.
And wait, Jerry Meehan, did you like Jerry? Or was
I liked him very much. We used to play, he would play the violin, I would play the piano. We were friends, but somehow.
You know, Jeremy Hansen and I were friends, and we always used to fight.
Yeah.
And we were like nine, like wrestle fighting.
Right.
But for some reason, we had an antagonism towards each other.
But the word went around like wildfire, fight. So next thing is about 40 boys of my age and older around. And so, of course, we're now in it, fist square, and boom, 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 about four or five, you know, feints at each other. And the next thing, one of them hit me right in the nose.
Yep.
Blood came pouring down. End of fight.
Okay.
And so that was the end of that fight.
So you've won some, lost some.
So I lost that fight totally. And never again did I allow myself to be in a fight where it was fists.
Right.
It was always get close and then wrestle with the guy so you wouldn't get a bleeding nose or something.
I mean, I'll be honest, like I wish you still had a squaring off, just have a fight, fair fight. Once it's over, it's over. I just don't think that exists anymore. If I'm out in Toronto and some guy wants to front me, it could be life or death.
Oh, yeah.
You don't just square off while his buddies stand by if you beat him or vice versa.
Right.
Is it true that one night you tried to fight a guy who was hitting on mom? She once told this story. At a party, did you get mad at someone? Come on, tell the truth now.
No, I didn't. No, I never
tell the truth now, Dad.
No,
tell the truth, Dad.
No,
tell the truth, Dad.
No, absolutely.
The podcast, you can't lie on a podcast. It's a rule.
I'm not lying. I may have told somebody to back off who was, you know, coming on to mom, but no, I never had a fight.
Would you tell them to back off knowing that it could get violent if you wanted it to? Did you have that in your pocket?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
I think there's more to this story.
See,
I don't want to say you were drunk. Mom might have said that it was a late night at a party. And
maybe.
Yeah. How is your temper throughout your life? I mean, I've seen you have a temper. I've seen you honestly justifiably have a temper. But has that been anything you've ever had to control?
Yeah. Mm.
Talk about that, because this is what we're into now.
Well, a temper, yes. Normally, I was able to control my temper, as most civilized people do.
Right.
But now and again, I could lose it and get very angry at something which I thought was an injustice.
Yeah. Sure. No, yeah. Now, you know, aside from the fact that you and mom in a marriage, you're going to have some fights and you lose your temper there. What about in real life, outside of the house? Where, in what kinds of situations would you go, don't blow up, or would you blow up?
Oh, well, actually, the main situation would be generally the unfairness of life in politics, in social ways, such as poverty. I get very angry about that kind of thing. Seeing corruption around
right.
me, which I saw when I lived in Mexico, total corruption, and that would make me very, very angry. Those kind of things were always on my agenda to go after those, whether it was in writing, for example, a novel that you know I wrote, Power Game.
Yep.
That's a novel. In parts of it is very angry there.
So there's a difference to me between anger and temper. Anger is something you view something and you generally have an anger about that type of thing. Tempers were at flares.
Oh, I see what you mean. Losing one's temper. Yeah. I would lose it in the usual kind of thing. Somebody bagging into my car.
Right.
You know,
right.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
Or damaging my car and then driving away and not leaving it
alone. So we have this in common. We love people leaving our cars alone.
Right.
Yep.
So that
basic
that
life stuff.
But basically the answer is no. In my life, I would have controlled my temper by and large.
Now, in my experience, my temper flares up. Not too much lately, thanks to sobriety and working through that stuff. But generally speaking, when my temper flares, it's when something else in my life isn't going my way.
Yeah.
Did you find that to be your experience? Like, because if someone backs into my car today, I'll be frustrated, but it's not that big a deal. But if I'm like, didn't get the job, didn't get the girl, didn't get the check, I'm apt to be really mad at that point.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt. Unhappiness with one's life, losing an appointment or something like that, that will set the conditions for losing your temper.
Right.
This is well known, no question.
Okay, next question from Tom Palmer, who I've known since
Hi,
I was 18. Shout out to Tom. I love this question, by the way. He wants to know, what's the best night of your life? Like what, when you dig back, like what was just one for the books? And if you got a couple, we'd love to hear them.
Well, one of the best nights I had was...
And by the way, if you're listening and this is the first time, my dad's 91, born 1928 in Ireland, and that's half the joy of this podcast, is this is someone who's vibrant, healthy today and has a perspective on a whole epoch, almost a century of living.
One of the best nights I would say, I still remember vividly, was in a small village overlooking the water in Greece.
Okay.
And
I like where this is going.
We had my brother-in-law, Werner, had a boat which was about 33 feet long, which he had built himself.
Yep.
He was a professor of engineering. And I was with Renata, my wife, and with Werner, and with his wife, Mariana. And we're sitting on the deck having cocktails. The sun is just setting, and there's the water out there, beautiful. Around us, there are other boats and yachts. It was a superb setting, and I still remember that night vividly as among the most absolutely beautiful nights of my entire life.
That's beautiful.
Gorgeous evening.
And what I'm getting from you is an idea of peace and contentment. Is that what it was, or was it dynamic? What was the...
No, it wasn't dynamic. It was stasis. It was that feeling of sitting among loved ones and that everything is just coming together so beautifully that you have a sense of touching, you know, reality. Reality isn't quite the word. Touching peace, contentment. You don't have to do anything. You know, that feeling, dolce far niente. You know, nothing really matters.
Right.
Right now, this is it.
Dolce far niente, indeed. Yep. Well, you know, it's funny. You say not reality, although you touch upon the idea, but, you know, my definition of God is the great reality.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm in tune with reality, I'm in tune with what I consider to be God. And it's interesting because when you're describing that, I'm hearing a sense of infinitude. And, you know, that is reality to me.
The
connectedness, that peace, that nothing has to happen. And even when we talk about learned behaviors like racism or tempers, none of that's happening that night.
Oh, yeah. I think myself that there are moments in one's being where that people do experience it. So whether we are agnostics or atheists or Christians or Muslims, that life is very, very busy, you know. What is life but full of care if we do not have time to stop and stare? Those moments where somehow you reach into what you call it, you know, the reality.
The great reality.
The great reality. And most people do have that intuition where they touch what is the real thing, whether you call that God or whatever you have.
Absolutely.
It's too bad if people have never experienced that. The great poets do. The great mystics do. The great artists do. The great scientists do. You know, that moment. You could call it the Eureka moment. Wow.
Yeah.
And there it is.
And I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, that's part of the reason why I got so into drugs is because initially that provided that for me. First time I smoke pot, everything slows down. First time I try mushrooms, I'm getting all this perception. Then we get into acid, and you know, when you get into the cocaine and the heroin and all that, it's dreadful, but it's a version of that same belief that I'm actually getting in touch with something deeper. Yeah. Now, the great joy I've had is that in the 12 years since, I've realized that, oh, we got a phone call. Let's see who's calling. This is episode 3. This is our special segment called Dad on the Phone.
Hi. We're just doing the pod now.
He calls them a pod. Okay.
Okay, bye.
He dispatched them in short order. Who is that, Dad?
Ormond.
Oh, okay. That's my brother, Ormond. If he doesn't want to come by for the pod, then he doesn't get to talk on the phone during the pod.
Yeah, all right.
So I want to ask you this question, because you and Mom, and you before you met Mom, such avid travelers. I mean, you've traveled the world, and even before you met her, you backpacked through Europe. You literally got on a flight and then a train across Canada to start a new life. What do those trips do for you? I mean, why, when you're a professor in Guelph, you've got this gorgeous home with a pool in the backyard, and then you go, I need to go somewhere. What is the need? What does it give you?
Well, I think myself that for most people stay at home because I think of work, lack of money, and
that's
so
a big
on.
One.
That's
a big one. And time.
And I think that nearly everyone loves to go away, although what is so fascinating to me is that many people can't bear too much of being away. We had a housekeeper, and when she would go off with her children, they would immediately say after about a week, oh, we're dying to go home again,
right,
even though they were a very nice place. So there is something about the wanderlust.
Yes.
What's the German for that? Wanderlust?
It's wanderlust, yeah. We've anglicized the German.
And that has always been a part of my nature, probably because the homeland, which was Ireland for me, was an unstable place.
Sure.
And I think also that writers are stateless people in a sense.
Yeah. Writers are stateless people. I love that. I'd say that for most artists, if you're willing to.
I was going to say, for most artists, that they will go, well, the actor's a perfect example.
Oh, yeah.
An actor's terrain is where, it's where the script says. The script says Eritrea. That's where you go. It says Bulgaria.
Well, that's
it. Where you go.
And I'm not sure. I'm going to look this up while we're chatting because I want to get this right. I think it's called A Man with No Country. Is that the Vonnegut book? Let me look, because it's a brilliant collection.
Sounds,
A Man Without Country, Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah, it sounds like him.
I love it. It's a collection of wonderful pieces. And I that makes a lot of sense.
Well, it's like you, in one of your places where the script said you got to go there, the wonderful Greek island, do you remember you were on?
Yeah.
What was the name of that island?
Patmos.
Patmos, yeah.
Patmos.
Patmos for Revelations, yeah.
So you basically go because you have a wanderlust, and then what do you find, you know, you described that night in Greece with Werner and Marianne and Mom. What do you find? Does it fill your tank or does it stimulate your mind? I mean, when you come back to Guelph and you settle back in, what do you have that you didn't have before the trip?
I think you've been recharged in terms of imagination, physical landscape, new peoples, new cultures, new books, all of that kind of thing. If you've had a chance to live there for an appreciable length of time. For example, we've gone down to the Caribbean, Renata and I, my wife and I, and we have entered there very often into what the local people would call the Golden Cage.
Right.
And the Golden Cage is, you get out of the plane, they drive you to the resort, and there you have a lovely hotel, food, sand, sun, all that kind of thing. But you never see the people.
Yep.
You never meet the culture. Now, we were lucky enough that, for instance, going all through Europe, I always had a car. So we saw places that you would never normally see, because we had months of holidays that we made ourselves, that we actually took the time to do. Now, there's something interesting also, that we were lucky again as professors at university to have a sabbatical.
Yes.
In other words, every seven years you get a year off. But many of the profs, most of them, never use their year to travel because it was too difficult for them. You know, they had to find accommodation. What about the children? All that kind of thing.
Sure.
So they didn't go away from their home university town because of the difficulties.
Yep.
But we never did that. We said, we'll take the kids. Yep. We'll go, even though there are physical difficulties in getting away, because once you get there, then the rewards are fantastic.
Well, and also that's where summer camp that Orm and I went to was such a great gift for you and Mom, because, you know, to the listener, my parents would drop us off. We'd go for a month, if not longer, when it was later, and then you'd go, we'd get postcards from Dubrovnik or wherever you were sailing and doing your thing.
Exactly.
And that is the big thing. When I asked you that question, you know, I do think a lot of people, the one thing you mentioned is money, but also time. You know, when Emily and I used to travel a lot, we had to figure out that the day after Christmas until about mid-January was the only time during the year we could be sure that one of us wasn't going to be working or up for something significant.
Right.
Interestingly, we kind of traveled the same way. Like when we were in Morocco, you know, I see people who go to the resort in Marrakesh and you look at the beautiful pool and the spa and, you know, that seemed a little pricey at the time. So we just stay in little cheap riads and bounce from one to one and rent a car and go to Essaouira, drive up the coast. And driving a car in Morocco is one of my favorite memories of Morocco.
Oh,
because
yeah.
If you just take the tourist thing or whatever, which we did too, but it's a one-off. The tourist thing's a one-off and the living as part of the society's the what would you call it? The foundation.
Yep.
Speaking of, Emily has a question for you. Her question is this. You've been so brave in your lifetime, travel, moving countries, standing up politically, et cetera. Where does that bravery come from? Were you ever afraid? I'm going to say, obviously, how did you or do you deal with fear?
You know, that's a good question. And I will answer this way. I think sometimes that it was because I was reckless.
I think that's awesome.
And that's what it was. For example, I can remember you'd mentioned Morocco there, saying to Renata, there's a lovely place, we will go there for dinner. And out we went to go there for dinner, and we had to walk away from the main square, which was lit up, and now we're in these alleyways with very little lighting. So we're in a strange city.
And this is early 70s, right?
This is the 71,
72,
It's 72, 73.
Okay.
And so we're walking through these alleys. I don't have a map, really. And all I know is there's an address for this particular restaurant. I've got almond, my
I believe
son.
They call them souks, by the way,
souks,
the alleys.
That's right.
Yeah.
They do, yeah.
You can just ask me when you need to know things about Morocco, Dad.
I had a friend. Anyway, I've almond on my shoulder. Mum is very fearful. And I'm saying, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry. And we're going through this blackness of the night. And we find that the restaurant that we're going to is shut. And we say, oh. So I turn around and think, how do we get back again? But somebody comes along and says, ah, there's a very good restaurant there. And so we walk a couple of streets where he indicated.
Yeah.
And we open the door, and there we went in, and there's the most magnificent restaurant, about 30 feet high, the ceiling, stucco work, just a marvelous, marvelous, wonderful place. Now, some people say, my goodness, you were fearless. I would say maybe I was reckless there because I had my wife and I had a child.
Who was what, two at the time?
Two, and nobody knew
where
I was, you know, so that could have been reckless. So as some of that, as I characterized my life, I was in 1941.
Yeah.
I'm in Belfast, and overhead for 4.5 hours, roughly, there are German planes, the Luftwaffe, raining bombs down on Belfast, which, of course, was a great center of building aircraft carrier, that kind of thing. Our house is blown apart when we are there. The house around us all blown down. 25% of the entire housing of Belfast is destroyed in that night. Now,
hold on. I just want to pause because this is, again, part of the reason why I love doing this podcast with you. Anybody listening, I'm sure one or two of you might have the age to have been through this, but imagine 25% of the city in which you live being demolished overnight. I don't think anybody can grasp the scale or intensity of that today, who's from Canada.
Yeah,
You know, we're really lucky.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. It's incredible. So I'm in the middle of all of that with my mother and my brothers and sisters. My father is on duty in the police in a different, totally different part of the city, so we don't see him during these hours. So, I mean, all around us, destruction, bombs, fires, etc. And never once, although at that point I'm just coming on 13 years of age, I never feel fear.
Right.
Now, why is that? That may not have been, in this case, recklessness, but rather unawareness
sure.
of the danger that I was in.
Right.
In other words, sheer ignorance may have been it.
Sure.
So,
I mean, I love the honesty of this answer. You're saying that basically ignorance and recklessness are sort of guards against fear at times.
Right. Another time I was in an aeroplane flying from Toronto down to Boston to visit my family, and the pilot says, you know, we've got a real problem. The undercarriage isn't down. And we went through the entire drill right down to the count, you know, 60, 50, 40 seconds, et
right.
cetera. And then he cut off at 30 seconds. Now, obviously.
So you're preparing for a crash landing and possible death.
Crash landing. Everybody's weeping and praying, et cetera.
Yep.
And I'm probably at that time.
Coming out of the closet.
32. I'm not one bit afraid. I have no idea why not.
Right.
And I think it may have been because I didn't have, I wasn't married. I didn't have children. I had no, to use that phrase that comes up now and again in literature, hostages to fate.
Right.
And so I didn't
hostages
feel,
to fate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't have any fear at all. Now, later on in life, then I would be afraid.
Okay.
Once I hit about, I would say once I get into my 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But before that,
okay,
never.
So let me ask you about this because I know you had a pacemaker installed, about a decade ago?
Yeah, but 10 years ago, yeah.
And so that must have, you know, I remember your lips being exceedingly purple and the doctors were figuring out what was going on with the blood pressure and all that kind of thing. I remember you telling me one night that you thought you were going to die and you were resigned to it. You have since said you don't remember that.
No,
now, I might be making that up too. My memory's probably worse than yours. But did you have in your last, let's say, 20 years? Because I know you're very relaxed about death. We've talked about this since you're age 13 when you realize that you just have a fate. And maybe that's part of it. But have you had any fear around death relating to your health?
No.
No?
No.
So you never, like at night, felt yourself going, fuck, this is it, and I don't want this to be it? Or
no, no. And right now, at the moment, if you say, do I fear? Not really.
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah.
No, no.
No, I get it now. To be honest, I get it now, you know? I mean,
I mean, I've had
you've
a good,
won. You're
a
good, over the finish line. Everything's bonus.
Good,
and I don't say that with any macabre element. It's just like, I get it. But I can't imagine at age 75, when your heart starts not being great, that there isn't a sense of, this can't be it.
No, I never had that. No, no, never had
it. Well, good stuff. I mean, inherent stuff.
Let me put it this way. I shouldn't say I was aware of the fact of my mortality, but in my own case, that doesn't bother me so
right.
much. It's the death or the mortality of other people that gets to me.
Yeah. Sure. And so, you know, there's an interesting film called Free Solo about a guy who climbs insane sheer rock faces without any kind of ropes. And they measured his fear center, and he doesn't have one.
Ah,
he doesn't have one.
Yeah.
He's got this different type of mind where when he's subjected to things that he should be afraid of, nothing fires in his brain. You might have a version of that.
Yeah.
You might have a fear center that just doesn't quite trigger when most people do.
Well, it could be like pain threshold. Some people are very low and some people are very high.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, Josh Hanley, one of my karate brothers. Hey, Josh, what's going on? He has a question, and I like this question because I think we've been talking about you a bit too much. His question is, what about me makes you most proud?
The fact that Sean faces his own problems openly and doesn't try to hide at all. A very open person. And that, I think, is tremendously courageous to face our own faults. Because most of us, we do hide, we dissimulate, etc. And it's very rare to find somebody who is openly so frank about his failings or good points, et cetera, et cetera. That, I would say, is the key one off the top of my head.
Well, I appreciate that, Dad. I'm proud of that, too. Yeah. Okay, this one's from Andrew Boyd.
Yep.
Andrew, shout out, brother. Okay, for your dad, what are the top values he would like you to follow in how you live your life moving forward on a day-to-day? So what are the values you want me to have moving forward day-to-day? And I'll add the second part. Why are those so important to you?
Well, again, the ones that I've just mentioned, the honesty, to retain the honesty that you have right now.
Yeah.
Also to retain the generosity that you have right now, because you've always been a giving person. Sometimes, maybe in my opinion, maybe too generous, but those are wonderful traits.
Well, I got that from you and Mom. You guys were such spoilers. And, you know, I actually get more joy in giving these days than receiving. I know of.
That's good, because actually you're right.
There is point. Look, my life is so ridiculously spoiled, and I'm also lucky enough to be able to go buy a new truck when I need one, to go buy a mountain bike if I want. You know, I'm not rich, but I'm privileged. And it's interesting, because when, you know, someone gives me something, I'm sort of shocked, not at the generosity, because my life has been full of people giving me things. I just more mean that it feels lovely, but I'm more excited at the week lead up to finding something for someone and knowing that I'm going to surprise them and all that kind of thing. It actually gives me as much joy as getting something.
Well, that's good. If you could keep, actually, I think if a person, not just you, but if a person can enjoy the good things of life, like buying a new car, having a nice holiday, a lovely girlfriend, all of those things, a good meal, that's wonderful. But then at the same time...
Or boyfriend, or non-binary person.
At the same time, to have a... what would I say? To have sufficient detachment that you're not strangled by those things.
Well, that's what I had to find. Okay, so let's talk about this. First off, I want to go back to the honesty, which I really appreciate, and A, that I do have it, but B, that you want me to move forward with that, because so do I. To the listener, I had to learn that. Yep. You know, I got sober at age 32, and up until that time, I had been lying to either everybody or pieces of people, and it was effectively a way to maintain my alcoholism and addiction. Mm-hmm. You can't do as many drugs and drink that much and tell people about it without them basically showing up at your door and stopping you. Yeah. So then you have to lie. And so I actually, like, honesty was not an innate trait in me.
No.
It's something that I had to learn through a program. And effectively, then if I was dishonest, immediately feel the response of it and go, oh my God, living dishonestly is brutal. Now, saying to someone that's none of your business, or I'd rather not talk about it, that's not dishonest. But yeah, if I'm going to answer something, to be honest. But in any case, that was a learned behavior. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that, you know, so I had destroyed the first trajectory of my career. And by the way, it was my dad who helped me with this, because I felt so guilty and awful about what I considered destroying my career. You know, I'd gotten fired from a great job. I didn't work for years. And it was my dad who said, you didn't destroy your career. You affected the first trajectory. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that, Dad, because it was it was important to not be self-punishing, because my career is lovely right now.
Yeah, right.
And so obviously I didn't destroy it. But in any case, I had to rebuild my ability to have financial, what would you call it? I mean, I was broke. I was 60 grand in debt at age 35. So I had to rebuild what buying power looked like exercise my power in the world at age 36, 37, 38. But then what happened was I kind of got back everything I'd lost and didn't have the same attachment to it. It didn't do for me what it once did. In fact, the Porsche became more joyous because it wasn't an identifying feature. So that's one of the things you mentioned, is not to be strangled by it. But that's something I had to find by almost getting something because of partly ego, partly like childhood dreams of a Porsche, and then losing it all, getting it back and going, do I actually like this? Or is this just an extension of an egoic identity?
Well, I think myself, again, that the experts, they're people who could speak in this with real expertise. But I would draw a parallel with people who are in the spiritual life, who are trying to find their way. And there is a phase where mystics, saints, visionaries go through, and it's called the nox obscura, the dark night of the soul. And it seems, when you read the accounts of these people, that's a necessary phase before you find the light.
Every heroic journey has the cave.
Exactly. The cave is right. Or another expression that I think Eliot used, drawing from Indian philosophy, the way up is the way down.
Ah.
You know, and you've got to go through that cave, you've got to go under, you've got to go through the dark night before you get to the light that is out there.
Yep.
Now, some people never make it through the light.
I agree.
They get lost in that dark night because it is too much.
Yeah.
It is too powerful, and they retreat because to face that is an excruciating business, according to these people who write about it, the mystics, John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, and so forth. And so it is a little bit like the drug situation where, you know, Roger Holmes, the medical doctor, our great, great friend, who said that only 10 or 15% of drug addicts get out. They try and they try and they try,
you know what?
But they can't make it. And that is tough, tough, tough.
And I'd like to pivot that to the idea of the cave. I don't think a lot of people find and get out of their cave.
Oh, no,
I think a lot of people, A, don't seek it. I mean, you don't know you're seeking it, but if you're a real, like, adventure seeker, you're going to hit a cave.
Yep.
You can't not. And then you, for me, there's both the small and the big. The micro, we'll call it, is you're traveling for 6 weeks. Well, you're going to hit a crap week. Someone's going to steal your stuff. You're going to lose your passport. There's going to be the cave. Then you're going to get through it. And then for most travelers I know, the trip ends up being great, but there was a downtime to it.
Right.
But then there's the bigger concept of life whereby, again, if you're taking a proper trip where you're actually moving forward, you're going to trip and end up in the cave somehow.
Yeah.
And then it's up to you. Do you sit there? And I don't mean even the idea of wallowing, because that's a specific emotional idea. I mean, do you get stuck in fuck this or this is my lot in life or whatever? And you know, to anybody listening, if you're in that place, keep going. Don't settle or sit in something that feels shitty, because there's a better life if you keep going.
Oh, yeah.
But it might suck, and you might need to face yourself and make new choices.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No question.
Yeah. And it's funny, Dad, because talking about this, and this is, I don't mind speaking this way because it's as though we're alone. Jack Nicholson talks about in an old interview how everybody goes on about De Niro or Pacino, but he's actually the most method actor of all time. He says, he said this in an interview. I actually kind of believe it. Now, I don't want to get too specific about acting. It'll be boring for most people, but there's going and driving a cab for a month doesn't make you a cab driver. So that's, you know, that's not totally like, you don't become a cab driver. But what Jack Nicholson, his idea is that he just, in the real world, once the camera's rolling, it's him.
Yeah.
Like, period. And that, for him, is why he's calling it that. And I would actually suggest that it's, I don't want to slag on anybody, but personally, I feel like a mystic. And I think you are too. And I don't mean that in any aggrandizing way, but I know that I really am. Like, my daily life is about spirituality, but not through moon ceremonies, not through crystals, not through having to meditate. I actually find LA or Toronto to be more spiritually enlivening than when I would meditate in a monastery at the top of the Himalayas or a 1,000-year-old temple in Kyoto.
Well, wonderful, wonderful. I mean, what you're really saying is that institutionalized religion is not for you. And of course, it shouldn't be
for
anybody.
Well, and even institutionalized,
it shouldn't be for anybody.
Yeah, and I think that for me, rubber has to meet the road.
Yep.
That's my version. That's kind of what I'm talking about with the Nicholson thing. Like, you do what you want, but when the camera's rolling, is it you? Because if it's not you, then it's not method. And similarly, if you're meditating under a waterfall and find peace, but then come back to Toronto and traffic bothers you, that's not real mysticism.
No.
That's not real enlightenment.
No.
Not that I'm enlightened or you are, but I think the path has to be walked in the real world.
You see, everybody has a touch of mysticism about them.
Absolutely.
If they would let it grow.
Absolutely.
If they'd have the honesty to face it and say, go, go, go.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and that's, you know, it's funny because I started that path with my martial arts, which probably going to reference a lot because of this weekend. Okay, and then Andrew asked for me, what am I most proud of when it comes to you? How you've lived your life, family, career, and how you treat people, and how to apply those to my life.
Good question.
Great question, Andrew.
Great question, Andrew.
It's a little bit too much about you, though, so let's talk about me some more, Dad. honestly, my brother Ormond and I talk about this a lot. The thing that I'm most proud of with you, Dad, is your ability to get it done. Truly. I've never met a human who, no matter what is going on in their life, will just sit down at their desk and keep writing, will just keep packing up the house, even though the last thing we want to do is pack up the house, who will just go, oh, it's time for us to get to your Coast Guard appointment. Let's go now. Let's do it now. And since I was a child, I think that's the thing I've not only gotten from you. And to be honest, I have to work to implement it. Like, I think I have an inherently lazy streak. And sometimes I just go, just get her done. Just do what your dad does. Just, it has to get done. Do it now. And then, you know, your desk will never be clear, but you'll clear that item from your desk.
Right. There's a wonderful saying, well known in a novel by Charles Dickens, where the Micawber is the guy. And the statement is, procrastination is the thief of time.
Oh, yeah.
And you see, that's the thing. If you leave it and leave it and leave it, time is so damn precious.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're wasting time, you could be doing things with that there. Growing flowers.
Yep.
Writing a poem. Doesn't matter if it's published.
Doesn't matter.
You know, reading a script and preparing it. Doesn't matter if you get the part. Doing something rather than withering away.
Well, so I have some free time because the last couple episodes of my TV show, I haven't been as busy with it. And I was actually lamenting that to my housemate. I was like, man, I wish I was shooting more. And he goes, well, you've got free time. What are you going to do with it? It was a beautiful question. The next day I recorded that song I've played for you.
Right.
By the way, this I'll put up on iTunes in a little bit and you'll all be able to listen to it or stream it or buy it. Within 3 days, I'd created a piece of art that I'm as proud of as any scene I've shot on my Netflix show. And it took a little prodding so that I wasn't in self-pity and whatever. And it took doing the thing, which meant turning off my phone, getting into the basement, literally, and creating a piece.
Yeah. Well, you see, the thing is, I maintain that anyone who's got talent in any way, whether it's acting, singing, painting, construction, no matter what it is, that's the sin. You know, we wonder, what is a sin? A sin is not cultivating the natural gifts that we have.
That's it.
And the reason for that is the precious time you have, and it's very, very little, it's going to waste. Why not use it?
Well, so that goes to Andrew's last comment. He said, and tell him you love him. I always regret not saying that to my dad as much.
Oh, he said that.
Yeah, I love you, Dad.
Yeah, yeah. There you are.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Hey, Andrew. That's really beautiful. Thank you.
Very good, Andrew. I know.
Wow, feeling that one. Time, procrastination, time. Sins. Love you, Dad. Tamir, my dear friend Tamir. We've talked about this a bit, but what drives you to keep creating? You could chill the fuck out. You've got a pension. You've got a book coming out. Your book launch on November 14th, is that right?
November 14th, yeah.
At Ben McNally?
Ben McNally.
Okay, come on out to Ben McNally. Beautiful old bookstore. Go ahead, Dad.
6 o'clock to 8 o'clock.
Come The Symmetry of the Tiger, which is not really the impetus for this, but it was our first episode sort of theme. Come on out, chat with my dad, get the book, all that kind of thing. You know, it's funny. We're doing this podcast for fun. I take for granted that you literally have a book launch coming up. Like, you wrote and have a book being published. It's happened throughout my life, which is probably why I take it for granted. But what a lovely thing that we get to do. What drives you to keep creating? Well, you don't have to.
Writers, I think, have to do what they were born to do. And so from a very early age, I was writing, trying to write something. And so that has always been there. Going to the desk, and when I read about other writers, and it's the same thing. James right. Joyce, you know, struggling with his eyesight, almost blind, and yet day after day after day, he's going along there. So in my case, I can't account for it because there are no other writers
right.
in my family. It was just something I had to do. So I can't really define it beyond that.
So would if you had to choose your death, if you literally said, here's how, would it be at your desk with a pen in hand? Would it be driving along with me for a coffee and you just pass out? What would you like to be your last experience?
At my desk, writing.
I think that's pretty perfect.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen the Laurel and Hardy movie, which is gorgeous.
No, I haven't seen that.
Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly. Yeah. It's one of the most emotionally moving movies I've seen in the last while, other than Avengers Endgame, and I'm not kidding. That movie's brilliant. But in any case, the Laurel and Hardy movie, after Hardy died, Laurel sat at his desk until his death writing more Laurel and Hardy movies.
Oh, my goodness.
And he knew they'd never get made.
Yeah.
But he, that's all he knew how to do. And I think about it, having written a little, but the imaginative world of sitting and imagining his best friend and lifelong partner playing those scenes with him was how he wanted to spend his, I won't call them declining, I don't know what they were like for him, but his last years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, writers, it's the same with other people, writers love their creations. There's a lovely story told about Charles Dickens that one of his friends met him in London in a foggy night, and he saw Dickens going along with tears streaming down his eyes. He said, "What's going on? What's going on?" And he said, "My book just went off to the publishers. I've lost them." He'd lost his loved ones, his characters, whom he spent two or three years creating. And so you live among those people very, very much so. So if you think of writers, they are, well, I mean, it's a birth. You know,
right.
A birth. And a book is a birth too, you know. Off you go to the next one.
So here's another thing I'm proud of with you, Dad. And this is why people like, when I was, by the way, to the listener, when I was 8 years old or 9 years old, my friends loved coming over. Because my dad, and sometimes my mom, but usually my dad would sit them down in the living room and ask them about themselves. What are your interests? What are you up to? And I don't think an eight-year-old had ever been asked those things from an adult point of view of them not necessarily being children, them just being where they are in their life. And my friends to this day love chatting with you. And the reason I'm proud of that, Dad, is partly because it's a lovely environment to create. And obviously people felt comfortable in our house. But also, you just said there's a lovely story told about Charles Dickens. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. It's not told unless people like you tell it.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, Mark Maron does a podcast with William Friedkin, the director, and he uses a beautiful term. He, you know, Mark Maron intros his podcasts without the person there. I don't. And he goes, that, my friends, is a raconteur. And you are a raconteur because those stories don't exist unless you tell them, because there isn't a story told about Dickens that I've ever heard other than from you. And that's why like Neil McDonough and, our, and Brendo and all the people who you might not see as much, they love you and they love chatting with you. And that's why I think this podcast hit number 38 last week in comedy, because we've been fucking hilarious today, Dad. Yeah, we've been hilarious, but we've hit number 38. We're climbing the charts. But I actually attribute that to the fact that the people who've responded to me personally, they don't hear these quotes of T.S. Eliot. They don't hear the story about Dickens because, you know, there's a great line in The Newsroom, which I know you just watched, where he's sitting at the guys in his office where all the encyclopedias are, and it's the young exec. And he goes, "What do you need all those encyclopedias for? We have Google now."
Yeah.
And Jeff Daniels' character goes, "Yeah, but with Google, you have to know what you're looking for."
Right.
So I'll only search what's already within my frame of reference. But when I chat with a raconteur such as yourself, I'll get new frames of reference, like flipping open an encyclopedia.
Right. Well, of course, the reason why I have so many stories to tell is because everybody has stories to tell.
Everybody has them.
You know, when I meet we used to meet my students, and I would have at university a class of 40. I saw every single student, and it was because I'm marking papers, but I didn't just want to mark a paper with a name, let's call it Rebecca Jones.
Yeah.
Who is Rebecca Jones?
Right.
Who is
Jack? And seriously, who is Rebecca Jones, right?
Who's Jack Smith?
Yeah.
So they all had to come and
those
sit
both
down
sound like
with
pseudonyms
me.
To me.
And then I would chat with them and find out something about them. And so their paper was a human document. And when I was looking at that paper, it registered with me. And then when the second paper came along, I knew whose paper I was marking. And the reason for that was that sometimes there would be a radical change in marking, go from an A and suddenly be a C minus. And there had to be a reason for that. And now I could turn around and say, "Rebecca, Jack, come along and see me."
Yeah.
And it would turn around. There was usually a personal reason, not an academic one, why a student had dropped like that. Because if a student was an A student, normally they stayed that way.
Sure.
There's no reason to become C. And the reason usually was a personal one. Death, love. Well,
this is something, this is a humanist approach I always got from you and Mom, because you both at various times sat on grievance committees, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where students
right.
would, you know, state their case.
Yep.
And I remember all the times hearing at home about why you would forgive somebody's late paper, or why if they did drop to a C, you might let them take another crack or whatever. And it's because of that humanist approach, right?
And it was a very practical reason, because Professors usually say the paper's got to be in by, let's say, December 1.
Right. Now, like, okay, where are you going with this?
And so I've got 40 papers to mark there. I can't mark them by December 1.
Yeah.
So Rebecca, Jack comes along and says, oh, can I put it in December 5th? Well, why am I going to say you've lost 5%? I say, of course. Get it into me.
I have a theory. Problem.
Yep.
Rebecca and Jack were fucking, and that's why their marks dropped, because they got too into one another and they stopped focusing on their work. This is my theory. There's the comedy for you, folks. We're going to jump to 37 with that joke. One last question for you, and then we'll round it out with one of mine.
Yep.
We've touched on this before, but let's look at it again. Alden, having been alive for so long, what do you see as the most prevalent cyclical pattern or trend that's reemerged? It can be in politics, art, society, economics, but when you go, and we've talked about this a bit, but not this specifically. Ireland, 1930s, you're becoming sentient, you're looking around, you're becoming a little more aware during the war, et cetera, et cetera. What do you see as the most re-emergent trend, and in what area?
Fascism.
Yeah.
Definitely, but politically, I think if you look around the globe at the moment, the danger, the extreme danger, I think, is from fascist tendencies in society, nurtured to a great extent by social media, and that includes things like Fox News is a prime example, where sources are unverified,
yeah,
where an ideological stance is pushed to an extreme. You know, in my life, I have had in Canada friends from the party which I never voted for, the Conservative Party, for example. I was NDP. And among those Conservative friends of mine, there were many, many honourable, really good people who would not lie about politics, who would differ on their approach to things. But the manufacturing of lies, fiction, non-truth, it would never have been a part of their background. And to a large extent,
correct,
that still holds true. But it is alarming how much that has spread.
Yeah.
And I don't need to mention all the countries. The prime example being the United States. And in her books, Margaret Atwood, the one I'm just finishing now, The Testaments, that's documented again and again.
Yep.
The leader of the world, and it is a total ideological catastrophe at the moment.
Yep. Well, it's funny because Alden said, I got this question from researching fascism after watching season 5 of Peaky Blinders.
Oh,
so it's
right.
funny that and that's the very thing that you do see reemergent. And that we have touched on that, and that makes sense. Okay, the last question I want to ask, Dad, because we've actually chewed up a wonderful amount of time here, and I hope you've enjoyed listening, everybody. And I went to Western, and I had a very specific drive. I was looking at pre-med. I was looking at pre-law conceptually. I mean, these weren't actual programs. I had come out of active students' council. Volleyball was my sport. And within months at Western, I was so tired of students' council at my residence. Volleyball, I didn't make the team. I had the option of being an alternate but didn't want to be. I was just like, no. And within months, I was performing nightly, and I was doing karate. And those are the two things I still to this day do.
But before, you mean acting?
Yes.
Yep.
So basically, all of a sudden, my focus within months, I did end up completing my 3-year degree, et cetera, but it was all moving in that direction. Did you have a period in your life like that where a path you'd been on changed so abruptly and that has to this day been who you are?
Yes. Now, when you say that you changed abruptly, you didn't. You said suddenly.
Yeah.
No. When you were at Western, you say that then you began to perform, act, and karate. You'd been acting from a very early age.
Right.
I can remember grade 11, etc. You were totally interested in becoming an actor.
Right.
And had we pushed you a little bit more, but it wasn't due to pushing.
I don't think it was yours to do.
No, it wasn't mine to do, no. But you were very close to becoming an actor at that point. So it was always there. In my case, the turning point came when I was going to become a priest.
Right.
And then I recognized, after I was a few years into that, no, that was not my path. That was not the way I wanted to go. When I realized that I wanted to be a person dealing with ideas and especially dealing with people.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, not only the priesthood, But then later on, I was very close to becoming involved in the computer sciences.
Right.
And I would have been dealing with selling things like UNIVAC, you know,
right,
et cetera. But that wasn't my
style. Let's go out on this, because it actually wraps up a lot of what we've talked about in terms of courage, recklessness. You're in Vancouver working for Remington Rand. You're at a computer company, and you're essentially on track to become ground floor computer tech in this world. This is the late 50s, yes?
Yep.
And what happens?
Well, it was 1955. That's okay. Exactly the date. And I had been hired. There were two of us picked out of, I think it was 81, and on an intelligence test got me in,
yep,
to be trained there.
Yep.
And so I was faced then with a career ahead of me in which I'd have made a great deal of money.
And Orm and I sometimes wish maybe you'd taken that career, but we'll talk about that another podcast.
Right. But then it was a question of, I was dealing all the time with things like accountancy, going to factories, seeing how they worked. I mean, I won't go into the details, yeah, of that, much of which I've forgotten.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was in training to be a rep for a very, very, sure, large company on the ground floor, and could have gone on to make a great deal of money. But the thing that turned me off was an invitation to,
yes,
write a novel in Mexico. And so it was a choice then between dealing with those kind of ideas, humanistic ideas, or wrestling with a great machine called UNIVAC. That was the name of it.
So you basically get this, what is it, a telegram, a letter?
Yeah.
Tell me.
What, for the job?
Mexico. No,
for Mexico. It was a friend of mine, a Lutheran pastor.
Okay.
In training.
We all have Lutheran pastor friends, Dad. It's nothing to brag about.
And so I was the Catholic priest to be, and he was my closest friend at the time, and we were to go to Mexico together, and he would write and I would write. I got to Mexico City, and he wrote and said he couldn't come. He just met a beautiful new girl, and it was the will of God that he should stay. He should stay in Ohio with this beautiful girl. So there I was in Mexico City by myself.
So let me back this up. You're working for a computer company. You've got your future ahead of you. It's a great future by any first world standard.
Absolutely.
And you get a letter that says, Eugene, come down to Mexico. Yep. Let's write our novel together.
Right.
And you do what?
I wrestled with that for about a month.
A month.
And all the time I knew, I called him the tempter. And I thought, get behind me, Satan. I said, get behind me. But ultimately, I hopped on a bus and off I went, and down I found
and
myself.
You gave notice.
And I gave notice, and the notice was terrible because I told my boss, I still remember his name, Norman Cottrell, and I said, I'm not happy. And he threw me out of the office, and I realized that the term happy was totally irrelevant in a business-like setting like,
right,
that. And so I then, he literally threw me out, and then, not literally, but he said, get out.
Yeah,
get out.
You didn't have to use your jiu-jitsu training.
No. 2 or 3 days later, I came back and said, I didn't think my prospects were advancing fast enough, and he accepted that.
Isn't that amazing? That saying I'm not happy isn't okay, but saying I need to be more successful,
yeah, exactly,
he gets it.
Yeah, he gets,
sure,
it. Now, I do write in my memoir about that, and I suddenly thought, I mean, in a sense, I was an affront to all that he believed in.
Sure.
To all that Madison Avenue believed in.
Yeah.
A success meant, you know, well, you know what Madison Avenue means by success.
Yeah.
And here's this young man coming in, and here I'm challenging his values. And I have no idea what kind of life Norman, who was a very nice man, was facing. Did he have debts? Did he have a family to look after? Was he chained to that desk? And here's this young fella heading off for Mexico, out into the blue there.
Right.
Throwing away responsibility.
Right.
What could be more?
And how old are you at this time?
I'm 26 years of age.
26 years of age.
Totally,
great job. You just say, fuck it, I'm out.
Totally irresponsible.
Yeah.
Saying, screw it, I'm off. And so it's an affront to him and all that he stands
well,
for.
Well, and then you get to Mexico and your buddy isn't even there.
Not even
and this
there.
And this is pre-cell phone, pre-anything.
Yeah.
You can't text him and go, hey, where are you at?
No, no.
He's just not there. He's in another country. How long did you spend in Mexico?
I spent in the next 4.5 months.
4.5 months in Mexico.
And a magnificent place. It was one in my memoir. I write about that. There's a whole chapter
on that.
One chapter which said, what was Mexico like then? And that was 1950, the first 4 months of 1956.
Yeah.
Before, but I was lucky when I came back to Toronto. I think I had about $50 in my pocket.
Right.
$50.
Right.
But then I ended up in the arms of NATO. And the airbase teaching officers from Turkey, Spain, 10 different European countries,
right.
Pilots and bombardiers and navigators.
This was at Western.
That was at London.
In London. London.
That was my next job.
So, and then that led to your master's at London. So it all unfolded as it should have.
As it was destined to.
I just think that's incredible. You know, I mean, I've had my own versions of it, but I just love the idea that no matter how good the job was, it wasn't for you.
No.
And you just said, I'm out. I'm going to go to Mexico for 4 months alone. How'd the novel turn out?
That novel was not published, but it was very interesting. When I went in Western, when I first met Graham Gibson,
yep.
The writer, he was a student in his third year. I was doing my master's degree, and when he discovered that I was a writer, that I tried to be, he was so impressed. He said, that's incredible. He said, you went off and you did that. He said, that's incredible. Fantastic. And so he was enormously impressed. Guess what? A few years later, he did exactly the same thing. And that led to his novel. It was a groundbreaking novel in Canada at the time, Five Legs.
And he did that in Mexico?
No, he did that in Europe.
Okay.
And then later on in Toronto, it started in Europe.
Right, and he's grateful to you for that. He's been forever.
He said that was the beginning of his novel.
Yep. And just to put a button on this, if I remember, he asked you what you thought, and you wrote him about five pages, and in one page said there's one good sentence.
I wrote him a letter, which I still have. I think it was about 10 pages. At this point, again, I was with the military, teaching as a prof at the Royal Military College in Kingston.
Yeah.
And I wrote him the letter and said, yes, I thought there were two or three sentences that seemed to indicate he could write. And he said he loved that. And he was so pleased by that that he went on to write, and he wrote the novel again, which had all sorts of connection with Western and a young man who tragically, visiting his girlfriend, was struck in a hit-and-run accident and was killed. A wonderful young man called Wally, about whom I could tell lots of stories that involved Hemingway and people like that.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. And also, you know, again, I always make, it's not a joke or a glib reference. You didn't just text him, hey, great job, great book. You took the time, you wrote a letter, and you were willing, going back to Emily's question, to actually have the courage or recklessness to tell him the truth.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you read the letter, when I read that letter again, it was full of, I think you should do this. And then I end up by saying, you know, you'll probably be as mad as hell at me because I'm writing your novel.
Right.
You know, that.
But he appreciated it because he had something constructive to work with.
Yeah.
No, I love that. And I think more people should write 10-page letters expressing their truth to other people.
Right.
Does that sound like a decent button on our podcast, Dad?
Good, yeah.
All right, I'm going to drive to Gatineau and hang out with a bunch of friends and do a bunch of martial arts. What are you going to do this weekend?
What am I going to do this weekend? Sit at my desk and write a little bit more.
Of course you are. Thanks for listening, everybody. Chatting Between Takes, Conversations with My Father, EP3, in the can. My dad just snapped his fingers. I wish you could have seen it, because that's what that was.